We have begun the final unit, now that I've spoken. And so we have three more chapters left. The first one, starting right now, is about meiosis and sexual life cycles. Meiosis a little bit later, but first let's talk about sex. Sexual reproduction is just one type of reproduction, and it's the more recently evolved. All reproduction originally was asexual, and still the majority of reproduction is asexual, simply because by far the majority of organisms alive are bacteria, which reproduce asexually. But now we have both asexual and sexual reproduction, depending on species. And before we talk about pros and cons, which each of these has, let's first distinguish them, define them. Asexual reproduction involves just a single parent that, by asexually reproducing, produces some number of offspring, each of which is genetically identical to that one parent, and therefore they're identical to each other as well. On the other hand, sexual reproduction involves two parents, each of which donates some DNA in the form of chromosomes to the offspring. And therefore, since these two non-identical parents are mixing their chromosomes to produce the offspring, sexual reproduction results in offspring that are not genetically identical to each other and that also aren't identical to either parent. Now, it's not correct to think in terms of which one of these is better, because each of them has advantages and disadvantages. Based on what asexual reproduction is and does, though, what I just told you, under what conditions would asexual reproduction be a good thing if you were given a choice? When would that be advantageous? Well, no, because asexual reproduction doesn't ever involve.
Right.
When I say a choice, some like plants could do either. A lot of plants. I don't mean it that way. I mean, just
when there's like a mutation, like a disease that one parent might have, that could go to the offspring.
I don't know. I don't think I know what you mean. But why are you saying that asexual reproduction would be advantageous?
Because then you won't have to mix in with that parent that is infected.
Still reproduce. Reproduction is the key, right? The goal.
Yes, and don't think about it in terms of the answer is not that it involves you can avoid a partner, because there is no such thing as a partner if you're an asexual species. What I'm saying is that under what biological conditions would it be advantageous for a species to have asexual reproduction as its only choice?
Is it based on adaptation?
Yes. What is adaptation?
Being well suited to an environment.
Yeah. Sounds like you're studying a pretty good website.
Yeah, or if I'm reading those right now as we speak.
Is that from mine? Or?
Yeah, no, that's directly from
you. Yeah, that's true. Adaptation refers to how well suited a species is, or an individual for that matter. You can think of it in terms of individuals as well. So since asexual reproduction produces genetically identical offspring, that means the offspring of an asexually reproducing species or individual is going to have the same traits as the parent, right? When would that be advantageous? Well, if the individual that's about to reproduce is well adapted, meaning the particular set of genes that that individual has, which indirectly gives it its traits, right? If that set of traits that that individual has is just right for the conditions in which it lives, for its environment, in other words, then why would you want to make any change? Making a genetically identical copy of yourself means that your offspring should be just as well suited to the environment, right? That's the situation in which asexual reproduction is advantageous. What's the problem with that, though? The potential problem.
What if something changes within the environment?
Yes. The problem is that real environments don't stay unchanging. Real environments do change. And sometimes they can change abruptly and drastically. So what might be a set of genes, a set of traits that makes an individual well adapted to environment A might not actually be all that great a set of traits in the new environment if it changes. So if all you do is make copies of yourself, then that your offspring might be not so well suited. All right? Well, sex, on the other hand, is a genetic crapshoot. You never know what you're going to get at all. Because no offspring is like either parent, exactly. And so, it's risky. Because it's very possible, even probable, that an offspring won't be as well suited to the environment that the individual lives in as either of the parents was. But it's the fact that you make different versions, every time you make an offspring, it's a different version with a new set of traits. The reason overall that sex has been successful is that even though you can make individuals that are less well suited, you can also randomly make ones that are even better suited than the parents were, even to a changing environment. And those are the ones that get selected for, right? That's natural selection favors those that can survive. So they both have advantages and disadvantages. Another disadvantage of sex is that it involves two individuals. It's just more complicated, right? Even for species in which there's no mating, there's not necessarily mating in sexual reproduction, two oak trees never encounter each other. They don't get up and meet each other, right? Their gametes have to get together, but they never come into contact. That's still more complicated, though, than just involving one parent, especially when you have to factor in any expenditure of energy that's put into ensuring that fertilization, which defines sex, happens. Anything you spend energy on could potentially kill you if you live life on the edge, because it's energy that can't be devoted to surviving. So it's taking a chance, but in the long run it's been really successful because it produces a lot more genetic variety. We just see a couple examples here of one from each of the major modes of reproduction. This is a hydra on the left, as you see. A hydra is a protist. Do you remember what a protist is?
Not a fungi.
Well, it's a eukaryote that's not an animal, plant, or a fungus. So it can't be a prokaryote either. All right, yeah. Any eukaryote that's not an animal, plant, or a fungus is a protist. And some protists are sexual. This one happens to be asexual. And prokaryotes, in general, are asexual. So bacteria and archaeans are asexual. This hydra, there are different versions of asexual reproduction. I mean, the mechanism can be different, but they all result in genetically identical offspring. This one uses budding. Budding is more or less a new individual, a carbon copy of yourself sprouting out the side of your body and then eventually dissociating and being a free living individual that's just like you genetically. Whereas bacteria are typically just divided into binary fission. Redwoods and plants in general are sexual species, so they have two parents that can be involved. Although many species of plants, under the right conditions, can also reproduce asexually. So they have really the best of both worlds. Well, let's go to two and look at this photograph with the black background. Just that part of the slide is an example of what is called a karyotype. And what do you notice about that word? Etymologically speaking?
Karyo.
Yeah, the karyo part of that is the same root as in eukaryotic or prokaryotic. It's a root that means kernel or center, which for a cell, if it has one, it refers to the nucleus. So the reason that a karyotype gets its name is because a karyotype is a photographic representation of all the chromosomes in a eukaryotic organism, in a eukaryotic cell. And therefore, since it's eukaryotic, that's where you find those chromosomes, in the nucleus. Well, this one happens to be from a human, but you can make a karyotype of any eukaryotic species. These are chromosomes being photographed here, but this isn't a single shot. These chromosomes don't line up like this and pose for this. It has to be photographically manipulated to make a photograph, to make a karyotype. Well, think back to our discussion of chromosomes. When do we start using the word chromosome in the cell cycle? When?
After the full-on split of the sisters. Eventually.
Before then, actually. We don't see chromosomes. We don't use that word until the M phase, right? Earlier, what do we see? Instead of chromosomes. No? We see chromatin. The stuff that chromosomes are made out of, right? So all the material is there, but we don't see chromosomes until that chromatin condenses into tightly compact structures that are discrete from each other. We see them separately. That's when we use the word chromosomes. It's there the whole time, but we don't see individual chromosomes until the cell's about ready to split, right, when it's in the M phase. And when is that degree of compactness maximized? In other words, when are chromosomes as small as they're ever going to get? I thought I told you you're not allowed to forget the stuff you've already been tested on. Metaphase is when they are maximally condensed. So that's when karyotype photographs are taken in a cell in metaphase. Because when they're as condensed as they're possibly going to be, it's you have the greatest chance of seeing them separated from each other, seeing them as individual chromosomes, in other words. Well, like I said, they don't pose. They're going to be in whatever position they are in the first photograph. So the a karyotype is an arranged, doctored photograph that involves cutting and pasting, which in the modern sense of the word, you know, those words are modern words nowadays, but that phrase, cutting and pasting, comes from real cutting and pasting, which is how the original karyotypes were made. You take a photograph of a cell at metaphase, you print the photograph, so you have the paper photograph in front of you, you take real scissors and cut out each little chromosome, and then you arrange them by size and in pairs that have the same size as each other, and then paste them with real paste onto another piece of paper and then take a photograph of that. Nowadays, of course, you can just electronically cut and paste them, but it's the same process. That's not how they appear in the cell, in other words. But notice they are arranged. They're arranged by size, and the size goes down as you go up in numbers. But each number, notice, is really two chromosomes. Like number one here is shown on the left in cartoon form. That's easier to look at. There's two different chromosomes that are called chromosome type number one. These two chromosomes are of the same type. And when you look at the cartoon, you can see that each of the two number ones is replicated, which should make sense to you because of what we just said, right? You take this picture during metaphase. That's way after the S phase, which is when the replication takes place. So they're already replicated. Each consists of two identical sister chromatids. So these are sister chromatids. These are sister chromatids. But this one and this one are not sister chromatids. They're not identical to each other because the two number one chromosomes are not identical to each other. They're both number one chromosomes, meaning they are both of the same type of chromosome, but they're not genetically identical to each other. What I mean by saying that they are the same type of chromosome is that they're not only the same size as each other, they have the same number of genes, and those genes are the same types of genes. Meaning that collection of genes that's on the number one chromosome, those genes indirectly correspond to a certain collection of characteristics in the organism. And that's a totally different set of characteristics and genes compared to the genes on the other types of chromosomes. All right? But each chromosome has a certain number of genes corresponding to a certain number of characteristics. And in this cell, there are two number ones, there's two number twos, there's two number threes, and so on. But just because we say that the genes are the same doesn't mean that those genes are identical to each other. We'll talk more about this in another chapter, but there can be different versions of the same type of gene. And they might be that one of these genes of the thousands that are on here, they might actually be identical, maybe not though. But they're the same type of gene because they govern the same characteristic. Okay, now we have 23 different types of chromosomes here because this is a human. And we use 1 through 22 as numbers to number the first 22 of them, but the 23rd pair doesn't get the number 23 because it's special compared to the others. And this brings up two definitions, two categories of chromosomes, which is different from types of chromosomes that I just defined. The two categories are autosomes and sex chromosomes. Chromosome as a word, by the way, the soma part of that means body, and chromo means color, chromatic means colorful. So it means colored body, literally. But notice that the some ending is also in autosome. An autosome is a chromosome. So is a sex chromosome, of course. But there are different categories because autosomes, and auto means what? What does auto mean as a combining form?
Self.
Yes, like in autoimmune. You're immune to yourself. Your own immune system attacks you. Autosomes get that name because they aren't really involved in determining anything about the next generation, the sex of the next generation. They're really there for determining what's happening in that individual's self. Well, so are sex chromosomes to a certain degree, but they use the phrase sex chromosome to describe the other category because sex chromosomes partially, at least, define the sex of offspring, any offspring that are produced. All right? And for humans, which this is an example of, this karyotype's for humans, there are X chromosomes and Y chromosomes. So the 23rd pair is not called pair 23. It's just called the sex chromosomes, which could be either two X's or an X and a Y under normal circumstances. Okay, now, why is it that there are two of each type of chromosome here? There's 46 overall chromosomes in this karyotype. Right. In other words, because humans are a sexual species. So each individual has DNA from each of two parents. And one of the number ones is from the mother, the other number one is from the father, and so on for each of the other types of chromosomes. 23 types. Okay, now. Oh. Forgot about the word homologous. These two number ones correspond to each other because they contain the same set of genes, same governing the same set of characteristics. The genes that are in the number twos govern a whole other set of characteristics, like I was saying. So one doesn't correspond to a two, but the two ones correspond to each other, the two twos correspond to each other, and so on. And the word that we use for that correspondence is homology. So the adjective form is homologous. In other words, these two number ones are homologous to each other, meaning they are of the same type of chromosome. And we can also use the noun homolog, without the O-U-S ending, to refer to one of them. There are two homologs making up what we call a homologous pair. Each homolog is replicated and therefore consists of two sister chromatids. Now to three, for some more definitions that confuse a lot of people. So be careful with these and tell me if you don't understand it. It does confuse a lot of people. Specifically, what confuses people are the definitions for ploidy and for N. N is a variable. It has a specific value, but that value depends on the species. N in general, though, refers to how many types of chromosomes exist for that species. In other words, for example, humans have an N of 23. There are 23 types of human chromosomes. Corn has 40 types. Every eukaryotic species has its own N, in other words. But that's what N means. The number of different types of chromosomes, which is not necessarily the number of chromosomes that are in a cell. The cell that we just photographed for that karyotype that we just looked at doesn't have N total chromosomes, right? It has N different kinds of chromosomes. So that's what N means, how many different kinds of chromosomes there are for the species. Ploidy is something entirely different. Ploidy refers to how many of each type of chromosomes there are in a cell. All right. How many of each type? The type itself, I mean the number of types itself, is N. How many of each of those N you have is the ploidy. So, just look only at the picture here. I mean, you can cheat and look at the answers, but just make sense of this by looking at the picture. This cell has how many kinds of chromosomes? Based on the picture. No, it has six total chromosomes, but it doesn't have six kinds of chromosomes. If you were to make a karyotype of this, there wouldn't be six kinds, there would be how many? Three kinds, right? Because you have a big, a medium, and a small version. Just like you have the 23 different sizes in humans. Okay? So that means N equals what? Three, because N is the number of different kinds of chromosomes in a cell. I mean, in a species. Well, for this species, whatever it is, it's three. It has three kinds of chromosomes. Okay, but how many of each type does it have?
Two.
Right. It has two big, two medium, two small. Three types, but it has two of each of those three types. That's what the ploidy refers to. How many of each type there are. You see how that's different from the number of types? Well, we use a number for N. In this case, it's 3, but each species, it's a different number. Humans, it's 23. For ploidy, we don't use a number, we use a word. So ploidy is the general word referring to how many of each type of chromosome there are in the cell. But any given cell has a certain degree of ploidy, and we use different words for those. If a cell has, just like this one does, two of every kind of chromosome, however many kinds there are, then that cell is called diploid. Di meaning two. Or we could call that condition diploidy. On the other hand, if a cell has only one of each of the N kinds, then it's a haploid cell. Those are not the only two possibilities. You could have a triploid cell or a tetraploid cell and so on. But those are exceptions that we're not going to really talk about in this course. Most cells are either haploid or diploid. Those are the two major categories as far as ploidy is concerned. But do you recognize this based on those definitions? You recognize this cell as having an N of 3 and being diploid. All right. Well, whatever N is, which as I said depends on the species, we call that number the haploid number. N is the general haploid number. For any cell, whether the cell is diploid or haploid, N is the haploid number. A haploid cell will therefore have n total chromosomes. That's what makes it haploid. There's only one of each of those n's, n types. A diploid cell will still have a haploid number, n, but it will have 2n total chromosomes. That's what makes it diploid. Right? There's two of each of them. So 2n is the general way and symbols of saying the diploid number. And since in this case n equals 3, 2n equals 6. 2n is the diploid number, and this cell is a diploid cell. Notice that each of its six chromosomes is replicated, which makes sense. That's why you're seeing them as chromosomes, because that replication occurred back in the S phase. And why do we have two different colors? Right, the color indicates the parental origin of the chromosome originally. Of course, these chromosomes are the property of this individual, but they originated, the chromosomes originated in one parent or the other. And in this key, red means from the mother, blue from the father. So, there are how many homologous pairs?
Three.
And in general, there are how many homologous pairs in a diploid cell? If you didn't know the species, what would be the answer for how many homologous pairs there are in a diploid cell? There are n homologous pairs, exactly. And therefore, 2n total chromosomes, but n pairs. That all clear? All right. Let's go on to 4 then, start talking about sexual life cycles. We'll get back into this ploidy thing in a minute. To start out, we're using humans as an example, since we are humans and therefore we relate to this. But actually, the important thing that I want to, important points I want to make about this slide is are true for other species as well that are sexual, not just other animals. We're animals, of course, but all sexual species, not just animals. And what that point is that I want to make is that any sexual life cycle, meaning the life cycle of any sexual species, features a generation to generation alternation, or going back and forth between two important processes. Not within the lifetime of an individual, I'm talking about from one generation to the next generation, and so on. Keeps going back and forth between two important biological processes, which are shown here in boxes. And those are fertilization and meiosis. So fertilization will happen, and then meiosis, and then fertilization again in the next generation, and then meiosis, and so on, over and over. Not just for us, for any sexual species. Well, we better define both of these, since they're so important. What is fertilization? Do you already know what fertilization is? Fertilization defines sex. It's the hallmark of sex. Without fertilization, there is no sexuality to the species. Fertilization is the fusion of two unicellular gametes to produce one unicellular zygote. Now, gamete is a unisex term. A gamete is a sex cell. Any sexual species has gametes. But there's a male version of gametes and there's a female version of gametes. In a lot of species, they're called egg and sperm. They don't have to be. But egg and sperm are examples of gametes, right? There's a male version and a female version. Fertilization is the fusion of each of those two types of gametes for the species, the male version and the female version, which before fertilization, each of those is its own cell, carrying its own DNA. Right? Fertilization unites the two cells into one cell called a zygote. And therefore, the zygote that's created by fertilization, it's the direct product of fertilization, contains DNA from both of the two gametes, and therefore from both of the two parents. And this is why sex defines sex, because this is the reason why sex mixes things up genetically. It involves two parents' DNA being combined into one cell. Now, how would you describe what's happening to the ploidy if fertilization occurs? What is the ploidy of the zygote compared to either of the two gametes? Exactly. Fertilization doubles the ploidy. It has to in order to mix the DNA from two parents. Right? The zygote has to have two of each kind of chromosome, because each gamete is carrying a full set of chromosomes. So do you recognize that fertilization results in a doubling of the ploidy? Well, it just has to in order for sex to work the way it does. There's really no way around that. But if that were the only thing occurring each generation, each life cycle turn, then the species would quickly go extinct, because it would become impossible in a very small number of generations. And that's because the amount of chromosomes, the amount of DNA, would double every generation. Right? You could get two haploid gametes together to form a diploid zygote. The next generation, the zygote would be tetraploid, and then octoploid, and so on, doubling at every generation. Well, think about how astounding it already is for all of the DNA contained in a cell to be not only in an invisible cell, but in an even smaller nucleus within that invisible cell. If you keep doubling it, you're going to run out of room quickly. And you can't let cells get as big as you want, right? Cells are constrained by the surface area to volume ratio. So you can't just double the ploidy over and over and get away with it. But you do have to double the ploidy for sex to operate as sex. Therefore, for sex to work, you have to, in the life cycle, have a different mechanism that undoes what fertilization does as far as ploidy is concerned. Fertilization doubles the ploidy, so you have to have a mechanism that cuts the ploidy in half, so that you're back to where you started from, and then you can double it again, and then cut it in half again, over and over, and by doing it that way, as long as you're alternating between those two, over time you don't actually accumulate any DNA. You see that? That other mechanism that cuts the ploidy in half is meiosis. That's why meiosis has to exist, so that the amount of DNA doesn't keep doubling every generation, and therefore the species can continue to survive. So the any given, not just humans, any given sexual life cycle will feature meiosis and fertilization in that life cycle. And these two defining events also define the two parts of the life cycle with respect to ploidy. Any sexual life cycle features a haploid part of the life cycle. That's the seafoam green part of the arrows. Notice those are listed as N, which is the haploid number. And that same life cycle for that same species will also feature a diploid part of the cycle, 2N part. All right, so gametes from separate human parents get together in fertilization to produce a diploid zygote. The gametes were haploid. That produces a diploid zygote, which then undergoes mitosis to become multicellular human. And then each of those humans, the humans in that generation then individually use meiosis to cut the ploidy in half and produce new gametes, which can then get together in the next generation in another round of fertilization. All right? That's humans, but let's look at it more generally in slide 5. See three major groups of organisms represented here. Animals on the left, that of course includes us. So this life cycle for animals is the same one we just looked at, only it's generalized for all animals. There are differences between these three, of course, which we'll get into, but notice the similarity first, which I've already told you about before we got to this slide. Every sexual life cycle features a generation-to-generation alternation between fertilization and meiosis. That's shown in all of them. And every sexual life cycle features a haploid stage and a diploid stage. You see that in the two colors for each cycle. Okay. Animals, including humans, have a life cycle in which the diploid stage is multicellular, and the haploid stage is unicellular only. So that means as animals, we live our lives as adults as diploid multicellular organisms. And we tend to think, even though this is wrong, we think of multicellular adults as all humans being diploid. As being multicellular. Each of us right now is multicellular, but that's just one version of humans. That's the diploid version of humans. Gametes, though, eggs and sperm, are also humans. They are just the unicellular version of humans. They live their entire life as a unicellular organism. Either that life comes to an end because the gamete just dies as a unicellular organism, or an egg and a sperm get together, defined as fertilization, and that also ends the life of each gamete, right? They're no longer gametes once fertilization occurs. Now they're a new version of human, a diploid version of a human called a zygote in a next generation. That zygote then undergoes mitosis to become multicellular. You know, that's we grow up becoming multicellular diploid animals. And then we can produce unicellular humans of our own called gametes, which, if they get together, can produce diploid humans of the next generation, which become multicellular again. Is that all clear? That's one extreme. So let's look at the other extreme before going to the middle. The other extreme is represented by fungi, or at least most species of fungi. And they are more or less the opposite of us animals. meaning that their haploid stage is multicellular and their diploid stage is unicellular. Just the opposite of us. So a fungus, an adult fungus that you see, has a body made out of haploid cells, not diploid cells like ours. Lives its life as a multicellular haploid individual. And when it comes time for that adult fungus to produce its own gametes, it doesn't use meiosis to do that like we do. We use meiosis to produce our gametes because we're made out of diploid cells and the gametes need to be haploid. So we need to use something that's going to reduce the ploidy. Well, it doesn't make sense for a fungus's cells to undergo meiosis because it's already haploid cells it's made out of. You can't reduce it in half once you only have one of every chromosome. So a fungus produces gametes by mitosis, which doesn't change the ploidy. You start with a haploid cell from the body of the fungus, you produce more of them that are also haploid, just like gametes should be. Those gametes, coming from different adult fungi, can get together, just like our gametes do for humans or any other animal, in fertilization. That produces a diploid zygote, just like it does in us. But unlike in us, the zygote does not become multicellular by mitosis. It's only diploid as one cell, the zygote. And that one-celled zygote then undergoes meiosis to get it back to haploid. Those haploid individual cells are the beginnings of new individual fungi. Each haploid cell is its own individual, which then undergoes mitosis to become multicellular individuals. So they live their lives as haploid individuals. Is that all clear? Based on the definitions? Okay. Well, plants are shown in the middle, and that's kind of a special case. The life cycle, sexual life cycle of plants is often referred to as an alternation of generations, which is kind of a confusing term. Don't misinterpret that phrase simply because it has the word alternation in it, which I used earlier. Alternation of generations does not refer to the alternation between fertilization and meiosis. That's true for all sexual species, not just plants. What alternation of generations refers to is that in plants, both the haploid stage and the diploid stage are multicellular. That means for plants, there are two different multicellular versions of the same species. You can see here this plant that looks different from this plant. Those are the same species, but different versions coming from different parts of the life cycle. One is diploid, one is haploid. But they're both multicellular. The diploid part, or the diploid version of the species, is called the gametophyte generation. And that phyte ending here means plant. So gametophyte gets its name because it's the gamete-producing version of the plant. And the diploid version of the same species, also multicellular, is called the sporophyte generation because it produces spores. So for primitive plants, which means they've been around for longer evolutionarily, the original plants, which some species still exist, you actually can go out into nature and see both versions. They'll look like different species, but they're really just different versions of the same species one is haploid and one is diploid. For most plants, you don't see this, though, because most plants nowadays are examples of what are by far the most successful plant group, which are the angiosperms. So just about any plant that you name randomly is going to be an angiosperm. And even though they do have an alternation of generations, you don't see both versions because the gametophyte generation lives totally inside the sporophyte generation's body, which is kind of like a fetus in a mother, but for different reasons. You don't see the fetus, though, during that. Okay, but anyway, it's multicellularity for both haploid and diploid phases, unlike us and unlike fungi. Now to six. Let's start looking at the particulars of meiosis. Now, you've probably already noticed that meiosis as a word is very similar to mitosis. Don't confuse them when you read them on a test. Make sure you're reading the right word, because that makes a big difference. But meiosis and mitosis have certain similarities and obviously certain very important differences. And meiosis is confusing at first for most people, not just some people, most. So really getting a handle on understanding meiosis requires already having a handle on mitosis, which you've already learned and you need to recall in order to get this stuff today and onward. But you already know, for instance, that mitosis is part of cell division in eukaryotes, right? It's not the entire process, it's specifically nuclear division. And if you include it with cytokinesis, then you have cell division, right? Meiosis is a different version of nuclear division. And as I said already, meiosis exists because you have to have a mechanism to cut the ploidy in half to undo the doubling that occurs in fertilization. But meiosis is still nuclear division. It's division of the nuclear contents in a eukaryote. Here we have the simplest possible example, which, as I'll say in a minute, is actually too simple. It makes it harder to understand, I think, to have the simplest possible species here. What is N for this cell at the top for this species? It's one. That's why it's the simplest possibility. There's one type of chromosome here. Do you recognize that from the picture? There's just one size of chromosome. What's the ploidy? Close, but not quite correct. The ploidy is diploid. We use a word, not a number, for ploidy. So N is one, ploidy is diploid. Okay? Also, this cartoon at the top is really a lie. Why would you not see a cell like this? Even if, you know, it's possible for there to be a species with N equals 1, but why would you not see that cell the way it's pictured? Two of each one what?
Like in the first, when you saw the 23 pictures, there's like two.
There are two here. That's why it's diploid. There's a red one and a blue one. But they're both the same type. So there's only one pair here. So that is exactly the same. That's not the reason it's impossible or that it's a lie. What is the reason? Well, what's different about these chromosomes compared to the ones in that karyotype? There's two number ones here, right? But what's different about each of these two number ones compared to the two number ones that are in the human karyotype we looked at earlier? How would you describe each of these individual chromosomes? Anyone? Well, how are they different from the other chromosomes in this picture? Do you not see what I'm saying here?
They're separate, they're not together.
Well, the two number ones in the human karyotype weren't connected either. They were just two of the same type of chromosome. We have the same thing here. But this one number one here, how is that different from just the one number one of the human karyotype? This is an unreplicated chromosome. Right? It doesn't have two sister chromatids. That's the answer. These are unreplicated chromosomes, not replicated chromosomes. So why is it a lie? Well, tell me about the cell cycle. When does replication happen? It should definitely not be the case that zero people in this room doesn't know when replication occurs. Yes, of what? Right, that's when replication occurs. When do we start using the word chromosome in the cell cycle? What part of the cell cycle? When do we start using the word chromosome? The M phase, which is after the S phase, right? Why don't we use the word chromosome before that? Right, we don't see individual chromosomes until they condense, till the chromatin condenses, which is after replication. So that by the time you see a chromosome, it's already replicated. That's why this is a lie. Wouldn't see chromosomes unreplicated. It would just be diffuse chromatin at that point. It's the material that's in each of these, but you wouldn't see it as individual chromosomes. Of course, that would be confusing for the picture. That's why they went ahead and lied to you, but that's why it is a lie. Do you understand what I'm saying here? Why you wouldn't see it as unreplicated condensed chromosomes? Okay, but that represents a cell before the S phase. This is in G1. Then it goes through S and becomes replicated chromatin, which then condenses in preparation for meiosis into what we have here in the second picture. Now these are replicated chromosomes, and you would see, once you see them as chromosomes, they would already be replicated. That was my point.
Well, what is their point in showing us that as opposed to just the uncondensed version of chromatin? We would learn better understanding the fact that it was uncondensed initially.
Because you wouldn't see that there's even two pieces. You wouldn't be able to tell what the N is or the ploidy if all you saw is grayness. That's why.
Okay.
And also, of course, it's also a lie because it isn't a red version and a blue version. Those are just symbols. But anyway, just as for mitosis, a cell prepares for that division by replicating. Same is true for meiosis. Before meiosis occurs, there is replication, and that's why you see both cartoons here. Unreplicated and then replicated. Okay, now to one huge difference between mitosis and meiosis. Mitosis, hopefully you'll remember, involves one division event. And therefore, one cell that enters mitosis gets split into two cells that exit mitosis. Meiosis, on the other hand, involves two division events. And therefore, the overall process, meiosis, is split into what we call meiosis 1 and meiosis 2, using Roman numerals. Meiosis 1 happens first. It's not like the photosystems. 1 means first. And this is really the key to understanding this. So get this straight in your head. That's why I'm going slowly today compared to other parts of the chapter. Understanding this also really requires you to mentally compare what's happening here to mitosis. So even though we're looking at meiosis, let's first consider mitosis. And even before then, let me say that both meiosis 1 and meiosis 2 have subphases that are named the same as they are for mitosis. So you remember your subphases of mitosis? Prophase, prometaphase, metaphase, anaphase, telophase. You have all of those subphases in meiosis 1, and then all of those again in meiosis 2. But first I'm going to talk about meiosis 1. And even before then, I want you to imagine what you already know is true for mitosis, and specifically metaphase. What is special about metaphase? What happens? Well, there's cell plates only in plants. Metaphase plate. But what that means is that in metaphase, things are lining up halfway between poles, right? Okay, well, key to understanding meiosis is to realize that what lines up in metaphase of meiosis 1 is not the same thing as what lines up in metaphase of mitosis. So let's first remember what lines up in metaphase of mitosis. What is it that lines up? Yes, but yes, the chromosomes, but more specifically, individual replicated chromosomes. All right? Now, this is where N of 1 is actually too simple, because this doesn't really look like anything's lined up, even though they are. Let me draw you an N of 2 metaphase cell. If you have N of 2, that means there's a big and a small, right? And it's a diploid cell, we're going to say. So there's two bigs and two smalls. We'll say red and green. All right, you recognize that as N equals 2 in a diploid cell? Well, if this is undergoing mitosis, then what lines up during metaphase are individual replicated chromosomes. In mitosis, we do not use the word homologous, because the two number ones don't care what each other are doing. The two number twos don't care what each other are doing. You have two number ones and two number twos here, right? Because N equals 2, there's two types. But the two big ones do not come together. Each chromosome by itself lines up. And therefore, in general, if you have a diploid cell entering mitosis, in general, how many things line up? How many things line up at the metaphase plate for a diploid cell in general, for mitosis? What I mean by in general is that you don't know the species, but what would be the general answer for how many things are lining up? 2N. 2N, right? N is 2. There's 4 things lining up here, because each number 1 is lining up independently of the other number 1. Right? So it's two ends. If you have a diploid cell that's going into mitosis, at metaphase there are two end different things lining up. Well, for mitosis in the same species, so it has N of two also, it's not individual replicated chromosomes that line up at the metaphase plate. It's homologous pairs of chromosomes that line up. Like this. Do you see the difference? Which is harder to see when it's only N equals 1. These things are lined up, but it's only one pair. Okay? So in general, how many things line up during metaphase of meiosis? N. Right. Not 2N. Because before they line up, the two number ones find each other and come together. The two number twos find each other and come together, and so on through N. So it's N pairs of homologs that line up in meiosis, whereas in mitosis, it's 2N individual chromosomes. That is really important to understanding what happens next, which is really the essence of meiosis. Since it's different things that line up at metaphase in mitosis compared to meiosis one, that means the stage that comes after, which is anaphase involving a splitting, is going to split apart different things in the two processes. So first think about metaphase. What is it that splits in anaphase? I mean about mitosis, I keep calling it metaphase. What is it that splits apart in anaphase of mitosis? Not daughter cells. What splits apart in anaphase of mitosis are sister chromatids. Right? They separate from each other. They were held together at a centromere to make up one replicated chromosome. Those two sister chromatids, which are identical to each other, separate. We stop calling them sister chromatids and they are called daughter chromosomes. Right? That's when they become unreplicated. Because each daughter chromosome is enough for just one cell. And they're headed to one cell or the other. All right? Now, when that happens, I'm just going to draw one of the two cells since they'll be identical. For N equals 2, that means each cell is going to have a big and a red, a big and a small red, and a big and a small green. But they're unreplicated now, right? Whereas before they were replicated. What's the ploidy of this original cell? It's diploid. What's the ploidy of these two that it creates? Diploid. Mitosis does not change the ploidy. It just turns a cell with replicated chromosomes into cells with unreplicated chromosomes. Right? But there's still the same ploidy here. You have two of each type. You started with two of each type. So whatever the ploidy is going into mitosis, the cells coming out have the same ploidy. Not true for meiosis, for meiosis one. When this one splits, and I'll draw just one of these as well, what splits apart in anaphase are not sister chromatids, because it's not individual replicated chromosomes that line up. It's pairs of homologs that line up. And therefore, those homologs separate from each other. So, one cell is going to get one replicated chromosome that's big and one replicated chromosome that's small. I guess I will draw the other one just to make that clear. The other one's going to get the other big one and the other small one. Because the homologous pairs are what split. You see that? Okay, well, very importantly, well, what is the goal of meiosis? Well, more specifically. Right, to cut the ploidy in half. That occurs in meiosis 1, not meiosis 2. This already has occurred. What is the ploidy of this cell?
Diploid.
It's diploid because it has two of each of the two kinds of chromosomes. What is the ploidy of this cell?
Haploid.
It's haploid because it has just one of every two of the two types. So, the splitting in two of the ploidy occurs in meiosis 1. Because you don't separate sister chromatids, you separate homologs from each other. Well, since reduction of ploidy in half is the goal of meiosis, and that's already done by meiosis 1, why aren't we done? Why doesn't it just end there? Why aren't these cells ready to go?
You gotta split them more.
What, split what?
Chromatids, right.
In other words, the problem with these cells, the reason they're not done, is that you still have replicated chromosomes. You've reduced the ploidy, but you haven't solved the problem of having twice as much DNA as you need for one cell. Because each of the replicated chromosomes has two sister chromatids it's still made out of. You didn't split chromatids, you split homologs. So you need a second round of division to accomplish the same thing mitosis accomplishes, which is to split the sister chromatids apart so that each of the ultimate cells has just enough for one cell. All right? So you make two cells out of meiosis one. That's when they go from diploid to haploid. And then each of those already haploid cells undergoes another round, meiosis two, splitting the sister chromatids apart so that each of the four cells is now not only haploid, but unreplicated.
Is this the reduction of the 46 to the 23?
Well, in humans, that would occur in meiosis 1. That's, meiosis 1 is always when the ploidy reduction occurs. And by 46, you're not talking about ploidy, you're talking about total number of chromosomes. 46 is the 2N diploid condition for a human cell. So how many things would line up in mitosis for a human? Well, what's the general answer that I said? 2N. So for humans, it's how many things? 46 individual replicated chromosomes would line up. But in meiosis of humans, how many things line up? N, which is 23. 23 pairs. The two number ones, the two number twos, and so on. And when those pairs split, the homologs separate from each other, one cell is going to get just one of each of the 23 types. That's what makes it haploid, and the other one's also haploid. And then we stop using the word homologous because the homologs are in totally different cells at that point. Okay, so you've already accomplished the reduction in ploidy, but you still have replicated chromosomes to take care of, so you need meiosis 2, which is just like mitosis. It splits the sister chromatids apart, and the end result, assuming cytokinesis has also occurred in each of these, is four cells that are not genetically identical to the original cell and that are not genetically identical to each other. Whereas in mitosis, you have two cells that are produced that are genetically identical to the original cell and that are genetically identical to each other. Mitosis just makes copies. Meiosis makes haploid cells out of diploid cells. All right? And those are ready to go as gametes, which can come together in another round of fertilization to produce another diploid zygote of the next generation, which will grow up into, well, it depends on the species. For us, it would grow up into a multicellular diploid adult. Just in time for stopping for the day.